Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today we have two themes and two guests. The first guest is Rainer Fuhmig. He is a lawyer, and he is in Berlin, and he is looking at what can be done legally to get to the truth concerning the pandemic that we've been experiencing for the last year. He believes, based upon a group of lawyers and forensic experts examining all the data, that we have been misled, that a lot of the information concerning COVID is simply wrong, and therefore public policies like lockdown should be abolished, and those responsible for these repeated mistakes should be held legally accountable. Will he succeed? We don't know. But we want to find out, what is his case? What is the case that you're going to bring? Who are you bringing it against? And what is your evidence for this case? All this will be laid out by Rainer in just a moment. Then we have a medical doctor who was watching the documentary, The Social Dilemma. And it's interesting because he's giving us his perspective on what it means when these young tech persons are telling us about how we benefit from the world of tech, or how there's limitations and how it influences us and why we should have some concerns. So it's interesting to see how he's analyzing this. So we have that also. Now let's go to our first guest, Rainer Fuhmig.
I'm Rainer Fuhmig. I'm a trial lawyer, have been admitted to the German and the California bar for 26 years. And I have, my firm and I have over these years mostly represented consumers and small corporations against fraudulent large corporations like VW and Deutsche Bank. And I got into this because a friend of mine asked me to do something about this, and my wife sort of confirmed, yes, you have to do something about it, and that's why we returned from California to Germany in order to take part in the effort of finding out what's really going on. And now that we've more or less gotten a clearer picture, the big thing is to fight what these people are trying to do.
Is your focus on the PCR test?
Yeah, our focus is on the PCR test because if we manage to convince a court of law that this is a fraudulent enterprise, the PCR test being being marketed with the assertion that it can detect infections, if we can't convince a court of law that this is a false statement, then the whole house of cards is going to come crashing down because there's nothing else. That is the tool that they're using in order to keep people in panic mode. And there's no basis for this panic because, as I just pointed out, even according to the WHO, which couldn't quite escape the conclusions of John Ioannidis, the mortality is, or lethality, is roughly the same as that of the common flu.
So inconsequential, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
and also there's already herd immunity. That's another thing that has been overlooked. So there's absolutely no reason for vaccines except for the pharmaceutical industry to make money and probably cause a lot of damage as far as health and even there's probably going to be a lot of fatalities too, because these vaccines haven't really been tested properly. Usually it takes between 5 and 7 years to develop a new vaccine, and now this should be done, or they're claiming it can be done in 9 months or so. I don't think so.
And can you comment on your lawsuit you're going to do next week? This will be published.
No, this is not going to be one single lawsuit. It's going to be a number of different lawsuits that are going to be filed both on here in Germany, on this side of the Atlantic, and in the United States. We're here in Germany, we're going to start filing these lawsuits because we're a little bit ahead of the of our American colleagues, even though we've been discussing this for quite a while now in numerous Zoom conferences, but we're a little bit ahead of the pack, and so we're going to start filing these lawsuits here in Germany for damages against people like Drosten, Wheeler, and some of the others.
And can you hold them personally liable?
Oh yeah, because they're the ones that lied. They're the ones who stuck their heads out too far. They're not doing this on their own. They're making money with it, of course, but somebody else is pulling their strings, like Klaus Schwab and Bill Gates, who are lurking in the background, so to speak. But we have to start somewhere, and the intention that we think is important here is to uncover the whole thing, to use what we've learned through the Corona Committee, to use these pieces of evidence and the experts that we've heard in order to convince a court of law that this is a staged pandemic and that there's other goals, other people who are behind this and trying to push completely different goals. This has nothing to do with the world's health.
And how does an operation like this work, or how is it structured, do you think?
We don't know, and we don't care. Right now, we don't care. The evidence is going to take us there, in particular if we take advantage of the Anglo-American judicial system. In order to win this case against Drosten, we don't have to know who's behind him. We know, we can see that there's people behind him because he's just not smart enough to pull this off by himself, and neither is Wheeler. And we know from listening to many of these experts that they've been in touch with Wheeler and Drosten have been in touch with, in close touch with the players behind the field, the pharmaceutical players, like Roche is one of the big pharmaceutical players, or the Wellcome Trust that's, I think, Wheeler used to work for them or with them. So we know that there's something in the background, but it's not important for our lawsuit. For our lawsuit, we can concentrate on one thing only. These people lied when they're telling the general public that PCR tests can tell us something about infections.
And how could such a simple deception grow so large with this PCR test?
Because it's the panic. Bobby Kennedy, when he gave a speech here in Berlin on August 29th, that was the largest demonstration that this country has ever had, even though the mainstream media, there were more than a million people there. The mainstream media here made this into something no consequence, like they're telling there's 17,000 people or so that came together. We know because we had 34 lawyers on the ground, we're cooperating with members of the police force. We know it was way more than a million. But he reminded people of something that, not just of what his uncle said some 50 years ago, Ich bin ein Berliner, famous, absolutely famous. Every German will always remember this. But also of a quote of Franklin D. Roosevelt, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. And that's what they're doing. They're trying to keep everyone in fear by pretending, by using these marionettes like Drosten and Wheeler and Tedros, who's kind of slipped into the background right now, but trying to use fear so that people will believe everyone, even their closest neighbors and relatives, is a danger to them, could be a super spreader, even if they're completely healthy and show no symptoms. That's why I'm saying it's not just a lie about PCR tests can tell us something about infections. In addition, they needed to lie about people can be infectious even if they don't show any symptoms. And that's another thing, because Drosten knows that he's lying. When he first published a preprint, or he wrote a preprint about, on January the 30th, about how this woman from Wuhan came to Frankfurt and infected a lot of people without her having any symptoms. That was wrong. There was a journalist by the name of Kai Kupferschmidt who pointed this out and said, hey, this is wrong. This woman did show symptoms because she was taking anti-flu medication. You don't do that if you don't have any symptoms. But still, he published his paper without correcting this. So what you have here is lie number one, there can be infections without symptoms, so that everybody here is afraid of everybody, even though nobody shows any symptoms, nobody is seriously sick. And the second lie is the PCR tests with their positive results tell us about infections. And there you have it. That's the stage which is perfect for this panic, which is playing out.
So could you maybe reiterate the first one in a sentence or two, concisely, like, you know, we were told there was these asymptomatic spreading, and that's there, that isn't true. And,
sure.
And that's the basis of masks.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Mm, just because that's such a big point that I think is lost on a lot of people.
Yeah. So one of the law professors who advises us in the background pointed out to me, in this tort case, there are two really important lies that have to be put front and center. One is PCR tests can tell us something about infections. The truth is it cannot, in particular not the way these PCR tests, the Drosten tests, are set up, because everybody agrees that if you, using these PCR tests, you take a swab and then you have these molecules which are invisible to the human eye. So you have to amplify them by putting them into a machine, most of them produced by Roche, and amplifying them in cycles. Anything above 35 cycles, everyone agrees, is completely unusable, doesn't make any sense, it's unscientific. The Drosten test, just like the CDC test, by the way, which used the Drosten test as a blueprint, were set at 45 cycles. Lie number one, you cannot tell anything about infections by using these PCR tests. Because what they do is they test positive to almost everything, including, for example, the debris, the fragments of a common cold, of your immune system's fight against a common cold. Lie number two, even more important, I think, is he says that there are asymptomatic infections, which basically means anyone who's surrounding us, our relatives, our friends, and who shows no symptoms, who's perfectly healthy or appears perfectly healthy, could be a threat. That's what this induces. That's what this fraud, there are asymptomatic infections, induces. It tells us, oh my God, everybody could be potentially dangerous. That is not true. And we know that Drosten, when he wrote this in a preprint, knew that it was not true. Because he was referring to a woman from Wuhan who traveled to Frankfurt and who apparently spread whatever virus she had to a lot of people. And she, he claims, didn't have any symptoms. A journalist pointed out that is wrong. She did have symptoms because she was taking anti-flu medication.
So basically, this is just like the normal flu, where this, if you're sneezing, coughing, then you're infectious.
Yeah, yeah. Unless you show any symptoms, you are not infected. There is, I think, Dr. Mike Yeadon, he found a really great way of defining what an infection is. He says there's a cold infection and there's a hot infection. If a test, whatever test, finds or is positive, because it finds some debris, some fragment of your body's prior fight against a common cold, for example, or whatever. That doesn't mean anything if it's just there. Only if a virus enters your cells and then replicates are you contagious. And that's when you have symptoms. Meaning, if you don't have any symptoms, whatever virus is there hasn't done anything, isn't dangerous, is being probably killed by your body's immune system. It's only contagious, it's only infectious in that common sense if it has entered the cells and is replicating. Before that, nothing to worry about.
So if you don't have symptoms, you're not infected and you're not contagious.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And that's the big...
That's the big thing, because symptoms is like a sore throat or a headache or a diarrhea, whatever.
Just like the normal flu.
Just like the normal flu. That's what it all boils down to, yeah.
Yeah, because it's been really disgusting seeing these things in the media with people walking with blood on the ground and all this, like, this fear.
It's just plain stupid, but it works. If you, just like Bobby Kennedy said, there's nothing to fear but fear itself. But now we have a lot of fear. And many people have simply decided we're not going to think anymore. We're just going to react to whatever triggers us. Yeah. Whatever they use to trigger us.
And what's your goal with all this? Do you think you can get injunctions on these things, or get
Yeah, if we're lucky, we're going to get injunctions depending on which court we address. We have had not just lawyers who are trying to help, more and more lawyers who are coming out of hiding more or less, but we've also, the Corona Committee that is, we've also had judges calling us, getting in touch with us and asking us how they can help. They're not intending to bend the law or break the law, but they want to apply the law in order to stop this. So there is going to be lots more pushback than we can see right now.
And are there efforts to change the laws to make that harder? Or?
Yeah, the government is, in fact, they are trying to change the laws because just like in the United States, here in Germany and in Austria, more and more courts have declared governmental decisions which are not based on a parliamentary hearing on our lawmakers, the ones who we voted into office, deciding about these laws, but simply made up regulations. The many courts of laws, including the Constitutional Court in Austria, the Supreme Courts of Michigan and Wisconsin, a federal court in Pennsylvania, a Superior Court in California have said, you can have You, Governor, you can make emergency regulations for a few days, but then you have to get the parliament involved. You have to get the lawmakers involved. And that means you have to have a discussion about the pros and cons. What about the mask? Does it serve any purpose? Is there any other opinion out there that says, no, it doesn't serve any purpose? Are they maybe dangerous, in particular to children? Are there any studies out there? That's the kind of discussion that we need to have. And that's one of the things that we want to push as the Corona Committee, a public scientific discussion about what's going on. And that's what the other side, of course, wants to suppress, because once we have this, the results are going to be the same as those that we have had in the Corona Committee, because the people who we have listened to, the witnesses that we have listened to, are basically the same, plus some more, who are going to go to court. So they're not going to change their minds, I don't think.
And have any of the events this year changed your perspective of the world?
Any other events?
The events of this year, as it
is. Oh yeah, the events of this year have, as I said in the beginning, I was not completely surprised to see how governmental functions have been taken over by private corporations. The most important thing, however, and that's something that I'm still quite shocked at, the most important thing is that private companies like YouTube and Facebook are deciding about the range of the freedom of speech. They're the ones who are deciding whether or not somebody's opinion can be heard or not. That cannot be. We have to stop this because this is a sovereign task. It's up to the courts of law to decide whether some speech is defamation or whatever. But it's not up to private corporations to decide whether or not it is an opinion that is being told to the world through a video is covered by the right to freedom of speech or not. It's us, it's the people who have to decide about this.
So their behavior surprised you?
Yeah, what surprised me is how careless we have been over the last 10 or maybe 20 years, because the encroachment of our individual rights has been going on for a lot longer. This is just maybe the final stage of this plan, because there is a plan behind this. You know, there must be a plan behind this when it turns out that the pandemic isn't a pandemic, but it's just something like the common flu, and when it turns out these people who are telling us about these PCR tests are lying to us. So the next question, of course, is who's doing this for what purpose?
And what do you think this is heading towards? What do you think is the goal?
From what I've read, and again, this is not important for our lawsuits, but from what I've read and the people who we talked to here on this committee, historians and journalists, this is the so-called Great Reset that some very rich players of the corporate world, including Bill Gates, but also including Klaus Schwab. He's using his World Economic Forum as a meeting forum for the corporate elite, self-appointed corporate elite, and the self-appointed political elite to influence them, to manipulate them, to basically lobby them. What the goal is, probably population reduction is one of the goals, so that the resources of the world will last longer for those who will survive this. That, in my opinion, is one of the goals, maybe the basic goal.
So control and population, huh?
Yeah, I think so.
Some sort of managed reduction, huh?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Because you can read this. They're not doing this in hiding. It's out there. I mean, I think their last week's, was it Newsweek's article? I think their cover shows this eerie, ghostly person, Klaus Schwab, who is one of the people who is behind this.
And what do you say to people that are new to this or skeptical of this, haven't read all this material?
It depends. It depends on who you talk to. Like when we met out there, I was speaking to a cab driver. This guy is intelligent. Intelligence, I think, has nothing to do with if you have a law degree or a degree in medicine. But this guy is intelligent because he's asking questions. He wasn't wearing a mask, which was to me an invitation to talk to him, get a conversation going. And he drove me here and took us about 10 minutes. But within these 10 minutes, he began to ask me questions, sort of like what you're doing right now. And he was open-minded. But he was open-minded because he had already begun to ask himself questions. Some of the things that are going on don't make any sense to him, he says. And so I think maybe I got him interested in looking a little deeper and getting more information from the internet, because you can't get them from the mainstream media. As I said, they have been influenced in much the same way by these investors, Bill Gates and others' money, as the pharmaceutical and the tech industries.
And maybe last question is, I don't know, I'm from Washington, D.C., and all the so-called expert intellectual class, they seem to be some of the dumbest in situations like this. Why do you think that is?
What, again?
They fall for these things more, like people...
Intellectuals. Yeah, because they think they're much smarter than they are. I mean, I have some of the people who I went to law school with know everything about the law because they have learned many of the regulations by heart, many of the decisions by heart. But that's not all. There is another layer of intelligence which many of these people don't have. You have to be able to follow your gut instinct. You have to be able to put the dots together. You have to be able to, I guess what this is called is social intelligence. You have to understand what's going on, not just have a knowledge of certain individual aspects of the law in this case, but you have to be able to see the entire wood and not just one tree.
Like some street smarts.
Street smarts, that comes into play, but it doesn't, in addition, you need to have the factual knowledge. If you're a lawyer, you have to know about the law. But that alone doesn't get you very far. You have to understand. Street smarts is probably good, yeah.
Yeah, because in D.C. it's like 100% mass.
Yeah.
And then, but you go into the Midwest and the South, a lot of people are more skeptical. You know?
Yeah, in California, most out where we live, out there in Northern California, most people don't really care. I mean, they do put on their mask if they have to, if they go to... like in Reno, that's the closest larger city to us. If you go to a Walmart or any of the hardware stores, yeah, you put on your mask. But in those smaller towns, people don't care. Neither the shop owners or the employees, they don't care. They don't wear masks.
And do you think some of the changes in demographics of the cities and the countryside, that's a part of this plan or a result of it?
I can't tell. I don't know. Yeah. It could be a part of this plan, not a result of it, not yet.
It's such a big shift, isn't it?
Yeah.
You really have to change your whole evaluation where you want to live.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the reasons that I decided I wanted to be away from big cities. But this is not new. I've always been like this. I always felt like I'm being crowded in big cities. I don't like it when too many people are around me, when it's too noisy. I can't stand that. I love to be out in the country where there's only horses and cows and a couple of bears and rattlesnakes.
Yeah.
And my dogs.
Yeah, do you have any other comments you'd like to make?
No, I think I said it all.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. Huh?
Okay, you're welcome.
We will keep you posted with updates as this litigation proceeds, where it is upheld into the courts and where there is a rejection of it. We'll be having Robert Kennedy Jr. on and Mary Holland from the Children's Defense Natural Defense Fund to update us as well, because they're part of the action. Now let's go to A Real Doctor Watches the Social Dilemma.
Hey guys, a whole bunch of people have asked me to watch The Social Dilemma, a new documentary about social media and its ills on Netflix. So I'm a doctor, you're an audience, let's watch it together.
When you look around you, it feels like the world is going crazy. You have to ask yourself, like, is this normal? Or have we all fallen under some kind of spell?
Dramatic.
So I've been an investor in technology for 35 years. The first 50 years of Silicon Valley, the industry made products, hardware, software, sold them to customers. Nice, simple business. For the last 10 years, the biggest companies in Silicon Valley have been in the business of selling their users.
It's a little even trite to say now, but because we don't pay for the products that we use, advertisers pay for the products that we use. Advertisers are the customers. We're the thing being sold.
The classic saying is, if you're not paying for the product, then you are the product.
Let that sink in. If you're not paying for the product, then you are the product. Think about all the things online. Think about all the things online that are like that, including this show. The difference is, even for our show, there are people who pay for it, and then there are people who are generating ad revenue for us. And believe me, the people who pay for it get a very different experience than you do.
A lot of people think, you know, oh, well, Google's just a search box, and Facebook's just a place to see what my friends are doing and see their photos. But what they don't realize is they're competing for your attention. So, you know, Facebook, Snapchat, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, companies like this, their business model is to keep people engaged on the screen.
Let's figure out how to get as much of this person's attention as we possibly can. How much time can we get you to spend? How much of your life can we get you to give to us?
When you think about how some of these companies work, it starts to make sense. There are all these services on the internet that we think of as free, but they're not free. They're paid for by advertisers. Why do advertisers pay those companies? They pay in exchange for showing their ads to us. We're the product. Our attention is the product being sold to advertisers.
What I want people to know is that everything they're doing online is being watched, is being tracked, is being measured. Every single action you take is carefully monitored and recorded. Exactly what image you stop and look at, for how long you look at it. Oh yeah, seriously, for how long you look at it.
They know when people are lonely, they know when people are depressed, they know when people are looking at photos of your ex-romantic partners, they know what you're doing late at night, they know the entire thing. Whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, or what kind of neuroses you have, what your personality type is like.
Yuval Hariri has described this as, there will come a time, and it may be now, when the algorithms know more about you than you do. Because humans are the masters of denial and self-obfuscation, but these algorithms see clearly. They are tracking exactly what you're looking at. They can know whether you're gay before you know you're gay. Things like that are truly, they're amazing and terrifying at the same time. And again, these companies are dealing in attention. Attention is the currency that they deal in. And so even I, when I look at my statistics of my videos, when I look at how they're being served out, how many 1 minute views, how many 30 second views, how much attention are they getting, how many minutes watched, That's the currency that these companies find valuable. And as a creator, that's the pressure, is to produce that currency if you're going to survive in this. It doesn't matter about the message, doesn't matter about your mission. It's about the currency of attention.
A lot of people have the misconception that it's our data being sold. It's not in Facebook's business interest to give up the data. What do they do with that data? They build models that predict our actions, and whoever has the best model wins.
Now understand this. This sounds terrifying, and it is, but imagine this. If you build models that predict human behavior based on their past stuff, finding patterns, and computers are really good at this, algorithms are really good at this, you could actually predict who is at high risk for suicide, who's at high risk for depression, who's at high risk for going postal on a place. And that's actually interesting data. But then the question, the ethical question is, how do you act? How do you provide an action associated with that data? Does Facebook reach out to people who they think are suicide risks? I don't see that. How do you then actualize that? And if you have the capacity to save a life that way, or save multiple lives from a person that's ready to snap, and you don't do it, what does that tell you? I mean, we're only scratching the surface of the ethical conundrums that these algorithms are producing. And we're only like 5-10 years into this process. It's crazy.
I can predict what kind of videos will keep you watching. I can predict what kinds of emotions tend to trigger you.
For me, it's anytime someone gets hit in the nuts with anything. That's like ding, 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 all my dopamine. Now you know. And knowing is half the battle.
When I was at the Stanford Persuasive Technology Lab, this is what we learned. How could you use everything we know about the psychology of what persuades people and build that into technology?
Now, many of you in the audience are geniuses already. I think that's true, but my goal is to turn you into a behavior change genius.
There are many prominent Silicon Valley figures who went through that class, key growth figures at Facebook and Uber and other companies, and learned how to make technology more persuasive, Tristan being one.
Persuasive technology is just sort of design intentionally applied to the extreme, where we really want to modify someone's behavior. We want them to take this action. We want them to keep doing this with their finger.
You pull down and you refresh, it's going to be a new thing at the top. Pull down and refresh again, it's new. Every single time, which in psychology we call a positive intermittent reinforcement.
So you don't...
A slot machine. It's the same thing. You don't give a reward every time. You give it intermittently. Why do you think our devices require you to pull down and have there be a little delay, and then you get a refresh, whether it's email or social media or likes on Instagram, whatever it is? The technology doesn't need the delay. It can be instant. They put it in because of intermittent reinforcement. They want you hooked to that process. Think about that.
You don't know when you're going to get it, and you don't know if you're going to get something, which operates just like the slot machines in Vegas.
Exactly.
It's not enough that you use the product consciously. I want to dig down deeper into the brainstem and implant inside of you an unconscious habit so that you are being programmed at a deeper level. You don't even realize it.
Listen to that carefully. Programmed at a deeper level. It is creating unconscious habit energy that is very difficult to unwind because it's patterned, it's programmed. So you have to actually use conscious energy, a lot of ATP, to override it. But the natural default action is the behavior. These guys know exactly how to manipulate us.
Every time you see it there on the counter and you just look at it, and you know if you reach over, it just might have something for you. And so you play.
The whole time I've been recording this, I've been looking at this phone going, do I need to check email? Do I need to make sure I got that text? Do I need to follow? This thing is an albatross, and it's all conditioning. It's all like Pavlovian behavioral change.
If something is a tool, it genuinely is just sitting there, waiting patiently. If something is not a tool, it's demanding things from you. It's seducing you. It's manipulating you. It wants things from you. And we've moved away from having a tools-based technology environment to an addiction and manipulation-based technology environment. That's what's changed.
That's the central thesis of this. We've gone from something passive that you use as a tool to something that uses you as a tool. Let that sink in. That's the fundamental premise here.
Armed with all the knowledge that I have and all of the experience, I am fighting my kids about the time that they spend on phones and on the computer. I will say to my son, how many hours do you think you're spending on your phone? He'll be like, oh, it's like half an hour. It's half an hour tops.
I'd say upwards hour and a half.
Okay, I looked at his screen report a couple weeks ago and it was like 3 hours and 45 minutes.
That.
Instagram, 6 hours, 13 minutes. Okay, so my Instagram's worse.
That's an expert in the field at Stanford who knows all the dangers and our kids use it that much, right? This is a profound addiction that we have and our kids are the most susceptible. Gen Z, the people born after 1997, are one of the most anxious, neurotic generations in history as far as since we've been measuring this stuff. And yet they don't go out much. They drink less, they have sex less, they do all this risky behavior less, yet they're more anxious, more depressed, more actively suicidal. Why?
It's not just that it's controlling where they spend their attention, especially social media starts to dig deeper and deeper down into the brainstem and take over kids' sense of self-worth and identity.
That is the worst thing I've ever seen, and you see it in kids all the time. I just mentioned how anxious and depressed they are when their whole sense of self-worth is based on what they see on this little screen and the likes and the responses and the dopamine hit they get back and the fear of missing out. It is heartbreaking. And we're doing this to a generation that, look, millennials, I used to love making fun of because they're just lazy, entitled pieces of crap. Gen Z, you just feel bad for. We did this to them, right?
We evolve to care about whether other people in our tribe think well of us or not, because it matters. But were we evolved to be aware of what 10,000 people think of us? We were not evolved to have social approval being dosed to us every 5 minutes. That was not at all what we were built to experience.
What he said is key. We didn't evolve for this. This is a hack in our evolution. That our children, this generation, is not what they're wired perfectly to be destroyed by this. These little doses of affirmation that we become addicted to. It used to be you'd go out with your friends, you'd bully each other in person, and then you'd come home and you were safe. Now, especially little girls can commit acts of relational aggression from miles away with no consequence that they feel.
We curate our lives around this perceived sense.
Listen, I'm a dad of two young daughters. That's probably why this affects me so emotionally, because I am doing my best to create this environment where I warn my children about this stuff and I don't let them have social media. And yet they look at dad and go, well, but he's on social media all the time. And it seems his self-worth is based on how many views a video gets and how many positive comments he gets and how many likes he gets. And that is the worst possible modeling for my own children. And I try to tell them, but then I'm not leading by example.
Sense of perfection, because we get rewarded in these short-term signals, hearts, likes, thumbs up, and we conflate that with value and we conflate it with truth. And instead, what it really is fake, brittle popularity that's short-term and that leaves you even more, and admit it, vacant and empty before you did it.
Oh, that guy nailed it. How much fulfillment have you gotten from this kind of interaction on social media that's not transient? The Buddhists have been saying this for 2,000 plus years. That all grasping, all is ends in suffering, ends in dissatisfaction, right? And yet now we've created a societal hack where we've institutionalized this kind of grasping. It's the opposite of any kind of spiritual or personal progress that we could hope for. And we've societalized it. We've codified it in the structure and the fabric of society in our next generation, Gen Z.
Because then it forces you into this vicious cycle where you're like, what's the next thing I need to do now? Because I need it back.
It's never enough. It's never enough. Take it from me. Take it from me, you guys. I started on this route in 2010. I never had social media because I wanted to be Z Dog MD and reach people and influence people and live my story, yada, 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 yada. Open YouTube, open Twitter, open Facebook, open Instagram. Tried Snapchat, hated it. Tried TikTok, hated it. Wished I could love it because it's more clicks, more likes, more love, right? You grasp and you grasp and you grasp and you grasp, and it's empty. It's never enough. You're never satisfied. And when I realized through just straight introspection, meditation, stepping off, that actually happiness is being here in the present moment with people you care about, connecting, doing what you're passionate about, creating, right? And that brings you absolute bliss, peace, happiness. This doesn't. And yet the addiction, the unconscious programming is still there. Look in at yourself and see if this is happening to you. It's not too late to fix it.
Think about that compounded by 2 billion people. And then think about how people react then to the perceptions of others. It's just it's really bad. It's really, really bad.
There has been a gigantic increase.
Oh my God. They have John Haidt. This guy is my intellectual hero. We have done shows and shows on Haidt's work, so listen carefully. I'm really curious what he's gonna say.
In depression and anxiety for American teenagers, which began right around between 2011 and 2013, the number of teenage girls out of 100,000 in this country who were admitted to a hospital every year because they cut themselves or otherwise harmed themselves, that number was pretty stable until around 2010, 2011, and then it begins going way up. It's up 62% for older teen girls. It's up 189% for the preteen girls. That's nearly triple.
Look at those numbers.
Even more horrifying, we see the same pattern with suicide. The older teen girls, 15 to 19 years old, they're up 70% compared to the first decade of the century. The preteen girls, who have very low rates to begin with, they are up 151%. And that pattern points to social media. Gen Z, the kids born after 1996 or so, those kids are the first generation in history that got on social media in middle school.
That is, every time I think we've reached the most important point in this video, it outdoes itself in what the most important point is. What John Haidt is saying, and he said this brilliantly in his book, The Coddling of the American Mind, is that this generation, particularly of girls, and there's many reasons for that, we've done videos on this, is so susceptible to this. And people think, well, no, you're da-da. Look at the numbers. Suicide rates going up, self-harm going up, hospitalizations for mental illness going up. And you look at when it started, it's when social media first becomes available. If you let your child under the age of 16, 18, have a social media account, you are playing with fire. I won't do it for my own children.
When you go to a page, you're seeing the same thing as other people. So it's one of the few things online that we at least hold in common. Now, just imagine for a second that Wikipedia said, we're gonna give each person a different customized definition, and we're gonna be paid by people for that. So Wikipedia would be spying on you. Wikipedia would calculate, what's the thing I can do to get this person to change a little bit on behalf of some commercial interest, right? And then it would change the entry.
Can you imagine that? Well, you should be able to, because that's exactly what's happening on Facebook.
That is exactly what's happening on Facebook. They're looking at what your political interests are, who your friends are, what kind of things you're clicking on, and they're feeding you information that further solidifies your echo chamber and your thought bubble. Then when someone says, hey, wait a minute, did you know this? And you look at them like they're crazy, it's because you didn't know that, because you've been stuck in one way of thinking that has been self-reinforcing. It's the exact opposite of having proper discourse, proper education, openness to experience and different ideas. It's the opposite. It's a siloification, an outrage factory, a bubbleification, and the end of the world as we know it. And I'm not making hyperbole here. How polarized has the COVID thing been? Do you remember, people who are over 30, do you remember a time when we were this polarized? No. Why? Social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, I don't care what it is. It divides us. And again, it's the result of these algorithms that are paid to do this.
More divided than ever, with personal and political polarization at a 20-year high.
Have more than a third of Republicans saying the Democratic Party is a threat to the nation, more than a quarter of Democrats saying the same thing about the Republicans.
So many of the problems that we're discussing.
Listen to me right now. If you're one of those people who posts on Facebook like the Republicans are some kind of enemy threat or the Democrats are some kind of communist threat, you are part of the problem. And here's the worst part. You have been manipulated into behaving that way because it's for Facebook's benefit. That polarization sells. You are being used as a tool of powers that don't even understand themselves if you behave like that on Facebook. People try to post that kind of crap on discussion group, the private discussion group that I host for my supporters, and I delete it. I don't let it through because now I've finally been able to see it for what it is. I was guilty of it. I was manipulated too. And when I realized what was happening, I refused to let it happen. I see people as good people across the board trying their best and listen to their ideas. If we let ourselves behave like this, this polarization, we are playing into the hands of technological algorithms that have no humanity whatsoever and are designed for profit. Don't do it. Don't do it. Seriously. Oh my God. Just give me a second here to rant. There are so many doctor friends I have that are on Twitter, on social media, and all they do is post political garbage all day. And you know what? They think they're being good. They live in an echo chamber where they only get exposed to one idea. And when you sit and talk with them, they kind of go, what? I've never thought of it that way. When you propose an opposing idea in a compassionate and connected way, they can't believe it. This thing is screwing us, you guys.
Maybe the government is using the coronavirus as an excuse to get everyone to stay inside because something else is happening.
Coronavirus is not killing people. It's the 5G radiation that they're pumping out.
We're being bombarded with rumors. People are blowing up actual physical cell phone towers. We see Russia and China spreading rumors and conspiracy theories.
Panic and protests in Ukraine.
People have no idea what's true, and now it's a matter of life and death.
The sources that are spreading coronavirus misinformation have amassed something like 52 million engagements.
You're saying that silver solution would be effective.
Well, let's say it hasn't been tested on this.
You know, when a pandemic with a fatality rate of an infection fatality rate of 5% hits us, we're all going to die because of this. We're set up for misinformation either. And you know what? It's not just limited to hoax and conspiracy stuff. It's also the mainstream media playing up the fear angle, playing up data and cherry picking data to show that it's that we should all hide in fear in our homes. Okay. That's not true either. So how do we find truth? We're not exposed to all the ideas in a way that's actually, it's not a false equivalence. In other words, plandemic doesn't get the same airtime as, you know, people dying on ventilators in a hospital. Is really complicated because here we've been on a ride where I don't know about you, but I am so terrified because we've been on my show, we've been talking about this for a long time. The polarization in the country, the misinformation and conspiracy theory promotion, the destruction of a generation of children through self-harm, mental illness, fear of missing out, body image problems, especially little girls. And the weaponification of grabbing our attention and addicting us to something that should be a tool that instead we are the slave to. Now, I don't have the answers. These guys are saying regulate them, change the profit incentive, these other things. I'm not smart enough to give you those answers, but I am smart enough to say this. Look at yourself. Look at your own usage. Recognize when you're being manipulated. It can be done. It just requires that one step of metacognition, of self-awareness, to watch it and go, ow, instead of...
Now, for those of you who are interested in one of two things, there's two things going to be happening the last 2 weeks of April. One is a very advanced anti-aging clinical study. We want highly motivated people, people who are not resistant to change, people who are very disciplined, so that you can do all the things. And we, for example, part of this is just watching classical philosophical classes from some of the great teachers like Joseph Campbell. And also when we're working out, very challenging workout twice a day, juicing, proper supplementation, counseling, one-on-one counseling, great meals, yoga, meditation, a drumming meditation, and to see what we can do to change your blood chemistry, to change your telomeres, to change your body's biochemistry, so you're actually starting a process of de-aging. That's one. The other is people who just like that have a chance to be in a beautiful, serene, bucolic environment with bumblebees. We have lots of hives and butterflies and great aromas from the aromatic gardens, and there are many aromatic gardens, and to de-stress, to be able to relax, to catch up on the de-stressing that you haven't done on a regular basis, so that you can have all the food and juices you want and come home reinvigorated. It's a big, big deal to do that for yourself, to give yourself that gift. And rarely do we. We get so busy with everything, we don't take the time for self. So if you want to take some quality time for yourself and be around a great staff, John Q, who's going to be doing water aerobics in our saltwater pool, power walking. He and I take people out in the gym, and no matter what your physical condition, he'll be helping you. Luann will be doing her one-on-one counseling. I'll be doing lectures. And we have a lot of staff who are almost all the people have overcome own obstacles in their life, and therefore they're growing. You can call Luann Panessi, and I'll give you her number, and then we'll get you signed up if there's room. I don't know how much room there is, but we'll let you know. You got to be screened by Luann, either way. Luann's number is 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. Thank you all for watching, and have a nice day.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.